Tēnā koutou, ko Kregela toku ingwa, he Professor Take ahau. A warmest welcome. I'm Craig Elliff, and on behalf of the New Zealand Centre for Law and Business, I'd like to thank you very much for coming this evening. Apparently some idiot's written a book, and that's why we're here. And I have I have an immense amount of pleasure to introduce Dame Susan Glazebrook from the New Zealand Supreme Court to do the launch. Let me tell you just a little bit about her. She is a very experienced Supreme Court judge. She has an MA with first class honours, and an LLB honours, and a diploma of business, all from the University of Auckland. She has a DPhil from the University of Oxford. And prior to being appointed to the High Court in June 2000, she was a partner in the national law firm of Simpson Grierson. She has been a member of various commercial boards and government advisory committees, and as Michael and I were just discussing with her, she is the joint author of a much acclaimed book on the financial arrangement rules, which I constantly referred to when I was in practice. She served as a president of the Inter-Pacific Bar Association in 1998 and was appointed to the Supreme Court on the 6th of August in 2012. I'd also like to congratulate her on becoming the president of the International Association of Women Judges. This is an organisation which has over 6,000 members, and Dame Susan is the first New Zealander to be its president. So I'm going to pass over to you now, if I may, and go and sit down.
Well, kia ora koutou. Thank you very much, Craig, for reminding me to launch this very important and topical book on taxing the digital economy. I've known its author, Professor Craig Elliff, for many years, and I'm going to leave that vague, as putting a number on the number of years means we can't keep pretending we're still very young. So we first met because we were both in practice as tax specialists, although in different firms. I'm not sure we ever worked on any transactions together, but we certainly met at lots of conferences. So even then, Craig's interest in the academic side of taxation was manifest. And I think I can say that with a switch to academia, he's definitely found his true calling. I always think of Craig as the quintessential professor, not, I hasten to add, the nutty professor stereotype, although I understand he does have a tendency to absent-mindedness. What I was talking about was the stereotype of the all-wise professor who's passionate about his subject with a major appetite for research, and yet someone who also has a passion for sharing his knowledge with students and through his many books and articles with the world. But I have to say that he does this in a humble and unassuming way, never claiming he's the fount of all knowledge and always willing to listen to other points of view. I think too that his time in practice means that he's particularly well placed to combine the practical with the academic and the theoretical. This, and of course his background in international tax, makes him the perfect person to write about the taxation of the digital economy. And I think it's probably not an exaggeration to say this means considering international taxation issues in what is effectively a new world. Given Craig's background, it was no surprise to me that his book seamlessly deals both with the theoretical and the practical. So it starts from first principles with setting the scene by discussing what cross-border taxation is and the fundamental concepts in international taxation of residence and source, and the inevitable competing demands of these two concepts. Craig points out that the tension between the two concepts also has a geopolitical aspect, given that developed countries tend to be net capital exporters and therefore have a tendency to favour taxation based on residence, compared to developing countries which tend to be net capital importers and therefore a tendency to favour source taxation. Craig then outlines the compromise between residence and source negotiated in the 1920s, upon which our current international tax rules are based. Naturally enough, considering it was negotiated so long ago, that compromise, with its requirements of a fixed base for source taxation, is not fit for purpose in a digital age. He points out too that the 1920s compromise was just that, a compromise between competing concepts and indeed between competing theories of taxation, which are discussed in the book in some detail, including the more modern notion of taxing according to value creation, which he sees as an extension of the benefit theory. And the benefit theory justifies taxation on the basis of a non-resident enterprise utilising and benefiting from the public services and infrastructure of a particular state in which it's doing business. So it's very tied in with the corporate social responsibility movement that we're looking at the moment. So on balance, Craig comes down on the side of the benefit theory being able to justify and deal with the taxation of digital enterprises. But the careful discussion before he comes to this conclusion is typical of Craig being able to see all sides of an argument. The book then moves to a discussion of the characteristics of the digital economy and the different models of that, with the conclusion that it's not possible to ring-fence the digital economy from the rest of the economy. And of course, this is another major challenge for taxation design. This then leads on to a discussion of the particular challenges to the tax system posed by the digitalisation of business, including the current requirement for a physical presence in order to tax non-residents, the importance to digital businesses of intellectual property and the mobility of intellectual property, and competition between states, which leads him to doubt about whether we're going to reach a consensus on the way forward, as against self-interest prevailing. Craig then moves to discuss two broad options that would allow some of the challenges to be dealt with. So broadly, the choice he posits is between a multilateral framework with amendments to the 1920s framework, or an increasing number of countries imposing unilateral domestic taxes, but in the context of existing legal constraints, and in particular double tax agreements and the World Trade Organization responsibilities. The second part of the book, that wasn't the whole book by the way, the second part of the book then goes on to look at these possible responses and in quite a lot of detail, including the OECD initiatives and what he terms the 2020s compromise, so 1920s to 2020s. He raises a raft of issues that need to be considered, even if international consensus can be achieved, and typically traces the development of and alternative proposals to the 2020s compromise and the extent to which they fed into that compromise. The book concludes that we're now at the crossroads. One of the consequences, he says, of the COVID-19 crisis is that there is a greater sense of urgency in terms of international tax reform because businesses and workers had to be supported by governments during the crisis, creating fiscal holes that need to be filled. This means that while there's more impetus for a multilateral solution, if this doesn't happen quickly enough, there are likely to be more and more interim unilateral solutions. The main unilateral solution is likely to be a digital services tax, which is narrowly targeted at certain highly digitised business models and is already used by a number of jurisdictions. So in order to ensure that such taxes don't fall foul of existing double tax agreements, they must be imposed as excise taxes on gross income. This means possible overtaxation and taxes will also not be creditable against all other direct income taxes, which again means there could be double taxation. It's worth noting too that the US is opposed to such taxes as it considers they unfairly target US corporates. And of course it is a very narrow taxation looking just at those digitised businesses rather than the digital economy as a whole. Now in terms of our response in New Zealand, the government has expressed a preference for a multilateral solution but has said that it will introduce a digital services tax if the OECD process has stalled. Now, just to show how topical all this is and how well he did to finish the book exactly when he did, we come to the G7 meeting in Cornwall and the two-pronged announcement of multinationals being required to pay more tax where they earn money, even if they have no physical presence, and the minimum tax rate of 15% to stop the race to the bottom, and the publicity is concentrated a bit on that minimum tax rate rather than the other side of it. But these have been seen as significant step forward, although there has been major criticism of the 15% rate as being far too low, and also of the narrow reach and complicated formula for allocating income of multinationals to particular jurisdictions, and the fact that it's likely to, at this stage at least, only apply to relatively few multinationals. But that complicated formula means high administration costs for what's probably going to be little added revenue. In any event, there's a long way to go in terms of both legs of the G7 proposal. It first has to go to the G20 and then the wider OECD. And in the meantime, I think Craig's right, there are likely to be many more unilateral solutions. And I think the day after this was announced, Canada announced it was introducing a digital services tax, so the cards are falling, I think. And I think there may well be another book in this for you, Craig, but in the meantime, it gives me a lot of pleasure to formally launch the book, and congratulations, Craig.
Well, I'd like to start by simply saying a very big thank you to everyone that's come tonight. It's very, very much appreciated. Secondly, to my honoured guest speaker, Dame Susan Glazebrook, for her insightful comments, and thank you very much. I had no idea that I actually eloquently said all those things. In fact, I didn't, did I? it was a much longer diatribe. I'd like to particularly thank and acknowledge the enormous help from the New Zealand Law Foundation. That it made such a difference to me. Back in 2018, they made me their International Research Fellow. And their support made it possible for me to travel and spend time, particularly at Oxford University, in writing the book. Linda Hagen and Diane Gallagher, together with the board members, have been terrific. And my own university was also so helpful in terms of research and study leave. It seems strange now, like looking back, but I managed to do field trips to Israel, who have a very interesting view on digital tax, primarily actually relying on what I would describe as the dramatic force of their domestic courts to interpret things in a very pro-Israeli way. Italy, the United Kingdom, and France, of course, to understand what was going on, and later on when we were based in the UK, it was very easy to go to Paris, to the OECD, when they were doing their consultation. So I don't think I could have actually written this book if I'd been based here in New Zealand. It just wouldn't have been able to be done. You needed to actually see those people, and there were so many helpful people who put themselves out. I mean, I don't really understand why they did that. They were just very generous in spirit. So put simply, the fellowship allowed me to do something which, looking back, was perfect timing, really. We ended up coming back from Oxford on the 20th of February of last year. So, you know, sort of like just a few weeks, possibly a week actually, I suspect, before things got absolutely horrible. And it started already, because even while we were at Oxford, there were rumours of, and the English were starting to sort of look at Chinese tourists in a funny way, and it was all very difficult. So people around the world helped me to understand the problems that they had a much better view of than we did here in New Zealand. And there were many friends and colleagues actually who helped me and gave me an enormous amount of help. Cambridge University Press were and are a pleasure to deal with. And I have to say, this is a lifetime ambition fulfilled. When I went to Cambridge, I used to look at the bookstore, the Cambridge University Press bookstore, and hope one day that that I would have a book in it that I could go and buy, or possibly not even buy, just look at. Actually, really, I suppose. So I asked a good friend as to what I should speak about tonight. Okay, actually, it was Barnard. And he suggested that I should discuss some of the difficult and interesting issues that I encountered in writing this book. On this occasion, I took his advice, and there are two areas that I want to discuss. The first, which I think you might find interesting, this is chapter two, is that, and it's probably a reflection of my age, but I didn't understand how digital businesses work. So I needed to get on top of that. And that was actually a little harder than first appeared, because you needed to work out how multi-sided platforms operated, in particular, and the concept of network effects. Both those two things together are an absolutely critical part of the way digital businesses operate. And so I was still back in the space of wondering why social media platforms offered free access to their services and to their sophisticated programs. But it's all, of course, and I'm sure everyone actually already knows this, it was only me that went on this voyage of discovery, that they want access to us and to our networks. And in that whole new way of thinking about business, they were just very efficiently exploiting the network effect of attracting customers and gathering data. For the perhaps the older people in the audience, if you think about a shopping mall and how a plethora of good tenants attract a plethora of good shoppers and vice versa, then you have the basic model of Facebook or LinkedIn from a network perspective. And a shopping mall is actually a multi-sided platform as well, too, because there are both sides are servicing the other. But perhaps a better analogy for the older people in the room is of a newspaper. No one buys them for the ads. They buy them for the news, or they used to buy them for the news. But, of course, the ads provide profits and subsidise the cost of the production of the news part of the paper. And so, like the advertisers on social media network platforms, they provide the profits to these multinationals, while on the other side of the platform, the customers are busy showing pictures of their cute dogs and other animals to each other. So the second issue was that for a long period of time, I was actually really struggling with the fact that there didn't seem to be a solution to how do you tax multinationals. and these big global multinationals. It just didn't occur obvious, and some of the suggestions about expanding the definition of permanent establishment didn't seem incredibly viable. And what became clear over the period of time is that it was simply not possible to under the current rules, to impose tax on businesses that make billions of dollars of profits without physical presence in the countries in which their users and customers reside. And so the old rules simply had to go. And even if there is not immediate consensus, the future of international tax cannot remain in the 1920s compromise. That is simply not a possibility. And the 1920s compromise, as Dame Susan discussed, favoured residence-based taxation and only extended taxing rights to the country of source when there was sufficient nexus caused either by physical presence or by the legal presence of agents to constitute a permanent establishment. The 2020s compromise, which has been approved by the G7 so far, and which now progresses to be discussed by a broader group of countries with a view to achieving political consensus, departs from these tax principles in a hugely fundamental way. For certain very large companies deriving significant profits, some taxing rights have been transferred to the market countries. That's the country where these customers are located. And that means dispensing with the concept of physical presence, a nexus, the arm's length principle, and separate entity profit accounting. Those are all absolutely fundamentals of the traditional international tax world. It means allocating global profits, not separate entity profits, on the basis of formulas based on sales. It's an incredibly unforeseen transfer of taxing rights from the factors of production or supply to the factors of the market or demand. And just as a complete aside, it's rather curious when you think about ancient forms of taxation, such as taxing barges as they flowed through your river, or taxing goods when they came to your marketplace. It's funny that we have actually, to a certain extent, ended up in such a fundamental shift where there is this imposition of tax based on quite ancient historical principles. All that being said, despite the extraordinary changes that are coming, that are signalled here, I don't think the reform will necessarily result in such a significant transfer of actual tax. And that's exactly what Dame Susan was talking about. It won't necessarily mean that the resident countries are going to open up their treasuries to the source countries. That defies political prospects. But wait and see. And the implications of the fundamental change can't be underestimated, and it literally is the thin end of the wedge when considering future international tax reform. In addition to these extraordinary ideas about taxing the marketplace, a global minimum tax is proposed. I think that's a very interesting concept. It's dealt with in the book, but not in as great a detail. And the reason for that is because it's about non-competition between countries, and we're seeing quite a trend whereby the cooperation rather than competition is the current and this is designed really effectively to make sure that the race to the bottom in corporate tax rates doesn't occur. It's in no one's interest, actually, really. So those are the two points I wanted to discuss. I would be very happy to answer any questions, if anyone had any questions that they wanted to have answered. Yeah?
I'm just wondering, unfortunately, without having to convert reading your book, where the issue of taxation of licences has occurred, where a company operating as a claimed subsidiary in a particular country then pays a very large licence fee to the parent company offshore, worst case scenario, Eastern Ukraine or Belarus. But the whole concept of being able to tax the licence.
I think what you're getting at is by license you're thinking about royalties and a diversion of profits.
The diversion of profits back to the parent company, in effect, we are operating the business, but we are paying a large license fee in order to operate the business.
Yes.
In reality, you're a subsidiary company.
Yep.
You're getting around the total.
Yes, the answer is there. Some parts of the 2020s compromise do definitely deal with this, but actually, BEPS stage one also does, because it looked at, and by BEPS stage one, I've immediately sort of lapsed into jargon, I'm sorry about that, but it was the 15 action points from 2013 through to about 2018, so before the digital problem emerged. So transfer pricing, everyone kind of knows that there were a group of adults, being the multinational corporations, playing with the children, being the governments. Actually, that's a terrible analogy. There was an imbalance of power between the on the score. So the answer is yes. The 2020s compromise will deal with that, partly through the corporate, the minimum corporate tax rate, because a lot of the diversion of profits were then going to jurisdictions where there wasn't full tax imposed. Yeah, quite right. Scott.
Just two quick points. One about the book, one about the reset. For those of us who haven't read it, could you please tell us what exactly you mean by the digital economy, the actual scope of what that term is, and I'll ask the second question.
Yeah, sure. So that's a really good question, and it has been a moving target throughout the whole of at the time when I first started studying it, it was automated digital services that they were clearly targeting. It's even more focused, as Dame Susan was saying, on when you look at unilateral taxes. And so the digital services taxes are just aiming at particular forms of services which are in the nature of Facebook and Google and those types of transactions. Where we've ended up, actually, is with a scope and scale of much larger companies being affected, but a much broader definition. And so the concepts now will actually involve turnover and profitability almost without any reference to the digital transactions. So we've ended up with a revolutionary change which has been driven by the digital rules, and now has ended up into a much broader all profit capture.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of leads me into my second question, because I think your timing is also impeccable given the recent G7. but I'm curious, what is the actual connection in your mind between any multilateral agreement to have a minimum corporate tax and a multilateral agreement to have a digital services tax? Because particularly if you're right that the concept of physicality no longer rules taxation, then what is the actual connection from one to the other, if any?
I don't know that there is. I think the way, like any good compromise, it began with a group of countries who were probably the source-based countries, and they included, the particular countries were the UK, France, some of the Italians, actually the importers of those high-tech and some of the developing countries as well too. So they're very keen on Pillar 1, and the countries that are keen on Pillar 2 are primarily the Americans, actually, because they had the companies that were diddling everyone else on Pillar 1, and then they actually weren't getting all the tax themselves because they managed to divert it into a whole lot of low tax jurisdictions. So it is a combination of, like every good compromise, it's a mixture of everything, and it seems to be, I think, I hope, that it will come to a fruition relatively quickly. When I say relatively quickly, I imagine the complexity and the rules will take, you know, still several years to work through, and that. But the point is that there is movement. Right, probably last question, David.
Thank you, for Craig, for your presentation. And you mentioned twice now the low tax or no tax jurisdictions, which includes, you know, Panama and Cayman Islands and British Virgin and so on, and even little old Cook Islands and our New Zealand story with the wine box. So where are we going to finish up with tax havens? Will they just evaporate because no one will be able to use them?
Sadly, I think there is always a certain type of person for whom a tax haven is an irresistible attraction, but the increasing level of discovery and information and the transfer of information makes it an ever-diminishing issue. So I wouldn't want to be in the business of being a tax haven anymore if I were looking strategically.
There's still a few dictators and criminals around.
That's right, exactly. That's right, yeah. So that will be their primary, you know, marketing strategy. which is not going to be great. No, pleasure. So with those two points that I wanted to discuss, I finally want to say thank you to my wife and family.